when it comes to the fiduciary responsibility, we now are seeing more just crazy stuff happening in the industry than we've ever seen before. Litigation, potential lawsuits, you know, everything from a broker getting in trouble to a stop loss carrier to a it's all over the board. So we figured we're going to end the year on a bright note by just talking about some of the stuff that we're seeing and what we expect to happen based on it in 2018. So without this being a 2018, what's going to happen? We came up with this title, but if you really want to know what this is about, it's about what's going to happen in 2018. So, as I mentioned, these are our speakers. And then I also want to make sure we go to the next slide and we let you all know to follow us on LinkedIn. Search for the FIA Group or just type my name in there. There's always new information. Matt Payton here at FIA does a great job in regards to making sure things are updated. He's our social media director. He has been fabulous to work with, even though I wanted to fire him for like the first, 2 months maybe?
That's a good sign, at least.
Yeah, at least 2 months I wanted to fire this guy. But, he's done pretty well over the past few months. So feel free to follow us on LinkedIn. And because of the great work Matt has done, I can't make this up, folks. I actually sent this to my old mother, okay? She said, what is a webinar?
That's not important.
So I said, it doesn't matter what a webinar is. Just know that we were the top-ranked one in healthcare in 2017. That's all you need to know.
Kind of
so whatever it
topic,
is,
yeah.
It's still we're the best. It's we're number one. But we are very honored that we were the top free monthly webinar in healthcare in 2017. It's a big deal to me. It's a big deal to Ron, Jen, Brady, and Matt. And the reason why we're top-ranked is because of all of you listening in and dialing in. So we want to say thank you very much for doing so. And yes, Joni Verinder, shout out to you. Merry Christmas to you as well, Joni. I know you love to chime in. All right, what are we going to talk about? We're going to get rid of Brady as fast as we can, so we're going to have him go first. But before we get into Brady, we will have a Brady special podcast tomorrow. It's like the Brady Christmas specials, right? I think Cousin Oliver used to come visit.
It's seasonal.
Right, Cousin Oliver. It was always like, remember that Cousin Oliver with his haircut?
Sure.
Right. That's Brady tomorrow. Cousin Oliver, Brady special political Christmas edition. Because, Brady, a lot's going on. We're going to have your own podcast tomorrow, 20 minutes, to talk about whatever you want to talk to. And if it starts making people fall asleep, Ron and I will chime in. We will also do a frequently asked questions with Jen McCormick. We're going to talk about why we're here, who a fiduciary is, what fiduciary duties are owned, and what you can do to protect yourself in 2018. So with that, based on a little, precursor to our podcast tomorrow, Brady, I know that we're seeing a lot of pushback in the media. We're hearing a lot of polls, CNN, Fox polls, et cetera, that everyone is not many people are very happy what's happening with taxes going on in 2018. So let's turn it over to you, buddy, and take it away.
Thanks, Adam. So, yeah, there's a lot to talk about here, so I can't wait for tomorrow. I'll be very excited to see what's going on. I want to let everyone know that while we're actually on this webinar, there's probably a vote happening, if not right now, in the next hour or so in the House, on this tax bill. But we have here a big, beautiful Christmas present that was promised to the American people, and that is, of course, tax reform, and there's a lot to go through here. It's been in the news a lot lately. It's happening very fast, and I've got it all covered. So,
speaking of, when I look at this photo, my sister brought me home from Vietnam Trump toilet paper. I think that's the actual face on the toilet paper, just so you guys know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
In Vietnam?
She brought it from Vietnam, like rolls of it.
Wow.
It's all over the house now.
So, as we may have heard, last week, the House and the Senate have ironed out differences in their different tax bills. This is a huge deal. This tax bill is $1.5 trillion. It's the first effort in really 30 years to overhaul the tax code. It affects our industry in big ways. I'm not going to bore us all at the moment with the details. This is basically cutting the corporate tax rate, individual tax rate, making a number of changes to deductions, doubling the standard deduction you can offer. But for our purposes, it also has a big deal in it because it's repealing the individual mandate of Obamacare. So for a while, it was unclear this bill would even pass, and there were some holdouts that just came on board in the last couple of days, including Marco Rubio and Bob Corker of Tennessee. But we expect that it will pass probably today in the House and tonight in the Senate. They do have the votes. The bill's over 1,000 pages long. And as I mentioned, the big bombshell for us is that it eliminates the ACA's individual mandate. And that's a surprise because you'll remember a few months ago on one of our podcasts, we talked about how the Democrats are very excited that the bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act was sunk in the Senate, wasn't going to pass. And now what we see is basically a piece-by-piece effort, starting with this individual mandate, to really gut out Obamacare. So why is it a big deal? Remember, despite what you may be hearing in the media now, it is a big deal this is going away. This was a mandate that was defended and attacked by lawyers on both sides in the Supreme Court. Millions of words were written on pages defending this law, and in two sentences in this tax bill, it's all going away. So what does that mean? Well, you'll recall that the mandate basically imposed a tax on people who didn't buy insurance. And the mandate was meant to address a problem that the Affordable Care Act on its own did not fix. So the Affordable Care Act was designed to make sure that sick people could get affordable coverage through two things called the guaranteed issue, which essentially means regardless of your health status, and through the community rating provisions. And that provision basically requires health insurance to offer coverage at the same price to people in a given territory without medical underwriting. Those two provisions in the ACA did not fix the problem called adverse selection, which basically means healthy young people like myself and maybe Ron would forego health insurance coverage because we didn't need it, right? Why buy it if I don't need it? What does that result in? That results in just sick people staying in the exchanges and in the markets generally. And over time, the phenomenon, which has been described as the death spiral, would occur, where insurers would begin to pull out, prices go up, more and more healthy people drop out of coverage, and eventually the spiral goes all the way down until you have a group of very sick people with super high medical costs, and it's really the unraveling of the market. And so that's the fear that could happen without the individual mandate. And so the Congressional Budget Office has projected a couple of facts on repealing the mandate. 13 million fewer insured by 2027 is what they estimate, and they project that premiums will rise in the marketplace and also for employer plans, and we'll get to that in a second, will rise by at least 10% in 2019. The truth is no one really knows how many health people will drop out of the markets, so we can't say for sure if the death spiral will actually occur. But it's safe to say the CBO did a pretty good review of what they think will happen with regard to coverage and increases in premiums, and we think that's going to happen as well. So what's the impact on our industry? What should employer-sponsored plans be aware of? Well, we should expect premiums to rise too, because insurers are going to raise their prices across the board most likely when this mandate is repealed. There's also the issue of the cost-sharing reductions, which you talked about a few webinars ago as well, where essentially health insurance companies are not getting subsidies to offer low-cost options to low-income individuals, and that's raising prices for them, and they're going to pass that on to us. So what can providers expect? Well, just like before the ACA, they can expect to see more people going to the ER without any health insurance, which means more uncompensated care and probably higher prices from them too. A couple other notes I want to add on this section is that there are other GOP bills that have been introduced aside from this tax bill. And this answers one of the first questions we had about the employer mandate. And the answer is that this tax bill does not touch the employer mandate or any other piece of the ACA. It does make a change to the health insurance tax deduction, which originally was at 10%. It was taken out of the House bill, put back into the Senate bill, and so now you can deduct up to 7.5% of your medical expenses. Otherwise, that bill does not address other parts of the ACA. There are other bills, though, circulating in Congress. One of them is to delay the Cadillac tax. Another one is to repeal the employer mandate retroactively. And one is to repeal the medical device tax. So essentially, you have piece-by-piece bills being introduced in the Republican Congress, in the House at the moment, in the Ways and Means Committee, which would further dismantle the ACA. The reason the Cadillac tax is a big deal, by the way, is because it taxes high-cost employer plans. And so if you expect prices to go up next year for employer plans, which many of them are, you can expect that Cadillac tax is actually going to become a pretty big issue. The reason, by the way, the Cadillac tax keeps getting pushed aside and not entirely repealed is because lawmakers see employer-sponsored insurance as an attractive way to raise revenue. And anyone who's in our industry knows that employer-sponsored insurance is not taxable to the employee. It's paid with pre-tax contributions. So that's why the dreaded Cadillac tax will not just go away. So one more slide, and then we'll be happy to jump on to the meat of the webinar. But what are we going to see states do? How are they going to react to the repeal of the individual mandate? One thing to note is there is one state who already has an individual mandate, and it's Massachusetts. And it's the only state in the nation that has one, and it's odd because you'll recall that Romney Care was obviously put in place before the Affordable Care Act. And when the ACA was passed, the state, our state, repealed many duplicative laws, but this was one that they did not repeal, almost like they knew this was going to happen. But so now, in our state, if you don't have coverage, you'll still face a state penalty, which means we should expect people in our state to probably keep coverage more so than in other states, which is why you're seeing these other states considering their own mandates, California, Connecticut, New Jersey, Maryland. So there could be – it's risky because it's unpopular, but this could be the response from states who are looking for ways to keep young, healthy people enrolled in health plans by passing state mandates. And one last note is I want to mention that a federal judge in Pennsylvania just issued a nationwide injunction which is halting the Trump administration's rules on the rollback of the contraceptive mandate under the ACA. Basically what that means is that the full court in Pennsylvania will have to hear this case, so we'll be watching to see what happens if the administration appeals to a higher court. But for now, the rules on the contraceptive mandate, as they were before the new Trump rules, are the ones to follow, and we'll be letting you know how that goes. And that's the update I have for now. I could talk for hours and hours more, but unfortunately we don't have much time. So tomorrow the podcast will be the place to tune in.
Well, thankfully we're done with Brady. So again.
So before we get into these FAQs, the one thing that I want to bring up about this, because I'm sure this is a question we're talking about implicitly, what to prepare for 2018. What do I need to know? So after going through those slides and hearing what potential changes we have to look forward to or plan for, what does that mean for my plan document? It wouldn't be a webinar if I didn't ask that question. So as of right now, the important piece that we're still waiting on the edge of our seats to hear how it's going to impact us is about the individual mandate and maybe the employer mandate. But one of the things that I always say is that the employer mandate, the individual, that is not a plan requirement. So there's not necessarily plan-related changes that are required here in order to deal with this tax bill. But because of all the consequences that may happen or may result from all of these changes, now is a really important time to make sure we are looking at the plan language to make sure that there are cost-effective solutions in place so we can counteract whatever happens as a result of the bill. All right, now to dig into our FAQs. All right, so one of the recent litigation or DOL lawsuits that has happened over this summer is important to bring back as a result of this webinar, talking about fiduciary duties and what has to be within the ASA. So the real quick background in this DOL settlement agreement, this related to a administrator who had breached their fiduciary duty by not being clearly transparent as it relates to certain fees and charges that were being charged to plan sponsors and plan administrators within their administrative services agreement. So as a result of that litigation and that settlement, there are certain things that administrators should take away and put within their ASA agreements. For example, and this may seem obvious, but it's always important to go back and revisit your ASA for many reasons, which we'll talk about actually throughout the webinar. The most important is review all the contracts that you have in place. Make sure that you understand all of the terms and conditions of the agreements that you're signing. You don't want to be obligated or sign up for a contract that you don't clearly understand or know what the consequences of that contract might be. Second, there is an obligation for monitoring of the fees and the services that are being charged. You need to ensure that if you are charging a plan sponsor or if a plan sponsor is being charged for service X, that they're actually receiving that service and the charges are reasonable. The last thing is making sure that there's not anything or a prohibited transaction that is going on, making sure that the claims and the funds are being used properly and not for a prohibited purpose, making sure that there's not a conflict of interest between the employer and the plan participants.
Hey, so Jen, before you move on to the next one, I want to just make sure all the people, listeners know, they can reach out to us for our administrative service agreement because we have made a lot of these updates to encompass many of the issues that you're talking about now. So
absolutely.
Instead of just saying, you know, cut and paste, try to redline, this could be something where they might want to just potentially replace their current ASA for the next plan year.
Repeal and replace, Adam.
Repeal and replace.
Oh, perfect.
All right. Next, so this question actually relates to groups that had been charging tobacco premium incentives, and they wanted to know what other opportunities they might have for their wellness program. So the thing to keep in mind when we're talking about a wellness program is that you have the opportunity to put an incentive or a potential penalty as a result for compliance or non-compliance. So while we can have an incentive or a penalty in place for our wellness program, we still have to make sure that we're treating everybody within the plan the same. The other key when you're putting in these incentives or penalties into your wellness program is to make sure you're cognizant, while it still exists, of the employer mandate. Because there still are, while it still exists, affordability requirements that exist under the employer mandate. So we can't charge, even with a incentive or a premium, coverage or charge for coverage that would be considered to be unaffordable. And last but not least, does the law require a plan to cover detox if the plan covers mental health and substance abuse claims? Obviously, this is a loaded question. So prior to having the case-by-case analysis of whether the plan is required to cover detox under the plan document, the threshold question must be, is it medically necessary? So you could insert detox with any other type of benefit possible. Prior to understanding or determining whether or not a claim should be payable under the plan administrator needs to work with a clinical reviewer, review their pre-certification, pre-authorization requirements to see what those might be and determine whether or not this is actually going to be medically necessary under the plan. The next step, after you determine that it may or may not be medically necessary, is to see whether or not the plan would potentially be treating these type of claims differently than any sort of medical or surgical claims to the plan, which would be a violation of the Mental Health Parity Act. So there's a two-step process, one, making sure it's medically necessary, and step two, making sure that as the benefit is defined, that it does not otherwise violate the mental health parity requirements within the plan document. And next, I think I'm going to be turning it over to Ron.
All right. Ron finally talked for 20 minutes.
Seriously, I've been
amazing, Ron.
Chomping at the bit here, guys. So I know we're going to be talking a little bit later about some of the recent LinkedIn posts that Adam and I have posted and some of the great feedback that we've gotten. But right off the bat, I just want to say for my post, I presented a hypothetical. And I got to tell you, if you're listening right now and you were on LinkedIn and you commented on one of the posts, particularly this one, it's adorable. Some people have actually responded to this hypothetical by saying, hey, Ron, have your client contact me. I've got the answer. And I'm like, it's a make-believe person. They're not going to be able to contact you. But for those who are wondering, the hypothetical is actually based on this real case, the Macy's case, which we've talked about in the past. In my example, it was something that didn't relate to reference-based pricing. It had more to do with the type of coverage, the type of service that was being paid for. In this actual case, it is a matter of not what you're paying for, but how much you're paying. And in this case, unfortunately, as in the hypothetical that I posted, the plan did not have plan language that matched their process. They implemented a new cost containment measure without implementing plan language that supported it, and that ended up biting them. So I call this issue where you do something proactively to contain costs, but don't implement it appropriately, the damned if you do. Okay, you're trying to do something, but you screwed up, and now you're damned if you do. The next example.
Before you go there, Ron, right? I just want everyone to know the Macy's case is literally could be called the case that Thea sees every day.
Every day.
Right.
This is something we see every single day. Maybe not the exact fact pattern, but somebody doing something proactively to save money for the plan, not being supported within the terms of the SPD. So the fact that Macy's got busted on this one, I already feel bad for them. I mean, even the Macy's parking lot today isn't packed, and it's a week before Christmas. You know, they're not doing well financially. They don't need this, too, when literally we're seeing this on thousands of self-funded employers do the exact same thing on a daily basis.
Yeah, and as far as these damned if you do scenarios.
You're going after all the retailers?
Higher
end.
I'm starting to think, you know who I think is supplementing the fees for the attorneys that are proceeding?
Amazon.
You're it here first. All right, so Nordstrom. So we've already gone through the damned if you do. Now this is an example of damned if you don't. Now this is a scenario where you have somebody who is running a program. Mind you, this is a financial plan, but I think it is synonymous with the health plans as well, because you're talking about the employees' finances, their assets. You're going and you're mismanaging the assets. This is a scenario where you have a program that is just kind of going along with the status quo. They're not proactively out there looking for better opportunities, better options to contain costs. They're, again, sticking with the status quo. And this, where you are basically, I don't want to use the word lazy, but you're kind of kicking back and letting it run the way it's always run, despite the fact that there may be opportunities to save money for the plan if you actually took some action, That's the damned if you don't scenario. So we have now discovered that if you are a plan administrator, you are damned if you do and damned if you don't.
That's more if you're a retailer.
A retailer, too. Get out of that business, folks.
Get out.
I will tell you, though, in my opinion, if you're going to be damned for doing. And hopefully do it the right way. And again, we'll talk a little bit about the LinkedIn post later, but there were some quality responses there as well as it relates to what you could do to protect yourself if you want to do without being damned for it. And why is this so important? Why is it important that you take action now? And again, we'll talk about the LinkedIn post and some of the great feedback we got of people who have kind of figured it out. And a lot of it is things that they're able to collaborate with us to do. Why is it important now, more so than ever before? I think it's because money is tight. Money is tight, people. Years ago, a few years ago, when the market tanked and people's 401ks and pension plans bottomed out, the knee-jerk reaction was to get worried, upset, and say, what am I going to do? The second reaction was say, who can I blame? And they went, and when you want to blame somebody and you want to hold somebody to task, hold them to task, what do? You look for an ambulance chaser, right? You go and you get an attorney and say, who are we going to sue? Whose fault is it that I've lost this money? And that attorney says, well, you know, who was managing the assets of your financial plan? Oh, it's the broker. It's my employer. Well, let's go after them. And that's what happened. So now, skip a few years later, and what do we see? The cost of healthcare is at a tipping point. People can't afford health benefits anymore. According to Brady, if they eliminate the individual mandate, all the healthy, low-risk lives that are supplementing the cost of healthcare, they're going to pull out, and now you're just stuck with people who can't afford healthcare anymore. So what's going to happen? Again, point the fingers. Who can I blame? Where's all the money going? Why can't I afford a box of tissues at the hospital? Well, because the last time someone charged $700 for a box of tissues, and they used up all your money on that. Who paid that? Oh, well, your plan administrator did. Let's get them. So if there's ever a time when it's time to really batten down the hatches and look at what you're spending and contain those costs, now is the time. Because I tell you what, they're running out of financial advisors to sue, and they're going to start coming after health plan administrators.
Ron, you got really close to me.
I'm pumped up. You know, I'm trying to protect you, Adam. I'm going to take the bullet.
I'm just saying, you know.
I'm going to take the bullet.
What is it, the Me Too movement or whatever they call it?
I got the
I'm just saying, Ron, I got to be careful with you. You got very close to me there.
All right. Well, speaking of something that's near and dear to our hearts, Adam, let's talk about LinkedIn.
All right. So as you all know, in Boston, we have a lot of traffic. So, I mean, literally, it's like an eight-mile ride from here to my house, which sometimes could take an hour, right, for that 8 miles. So I think I literally was on the highway texting, I mean, because you weren't moving. Technically, it's not driving. And I just put on a post because reading the Nordstrom case and all these other, you know, I hear about Wall Street, I'm like, man, all this money that is being spent by health plans, ASOs, carriers, et cetera, this is people's money. Like, that's coming out of their paychecks. And I'm saying to myself, I see claims paid at 100%, 98%, 95% of bill charges. No audit, no UN, nothing. And I said, you know, is there ever going to be a time when someone decides, like, that the 401k issue, what's happening in healthcare, is just as big, if not bigger, in how we abuse and waste people's money? I mean, this is an employee's money. And we got over 10,000 views, a bunch of the comments. And some of the comments that we got were, and it was all over the board. I want people to read these comments, like, just real simply. You know, it says, you know, it seems like it's an issue with the administration. Maybe. I mean, obviously, I would say. It doesn't matter if it's a carrier TPA. It really comes down to auto adjudication in many situations and just what that organization's belief system is. Do they believe and they should close their eyes and just pay claims? Next one says the TPA should give good advice and counsel to the client. You know, a lot of people would argue that a TPA is just an administrator. Mm-hmm. They're not, if they're giving good counsel and advice, that's like a broker now. Now that's a fiduciary. So, again, interesting comments. As an employer, it doesn't sign any agreement, doesn't allow you to look, audit, or manage your claims. Again, the employer has a fiduciary duty to prove a plan assets. They don't have to sign the plan doc. The plan doc is a contract because you're paying claims based on it. What's covered, what's not covered. Mm-hmm. I mean, if every person who had a denied claim, the only way it could be denied is if you signed a document that said, oh, yeah, that cosmetic surgery for that nose job is going to be denied before you actually have the surgery. That doesn't exist. Next, as an employer, I'd say the biggest contributing factor is the employer doesn't know what they don't know. 100%. brokers don't know. Or it could be the broker does know, but doesn't tell the employer. But I think a lot of this is going to change. I agree that brokers are not just brokers anymore. They are advisors. They are experts. They are, quote-unquote, counsel to the client. So I think it's a big deal. But here's the funny part. So I was making fun of Ron because I was like, oh, Ron, you've never had 10,000 views. You've never had this many comments, 17 comments, all these likes. So what does Ron do next? Ron decides to put a picture of Jed McCormick on his LinkedIn question, and he put a very long post because unlike me, I'm very quick, get to the point. Ron, you know, like so, is very verbose. He, you know, just goes overboard. But Ron, you want to tell me what you posted and then basically how you kicked my butt on the LinkedIn responses within hours. I mean, he blew my numbers away. But again, it's pretty clear to us that a lot of people have interest in this topic, in this potential fiduciary breach of what's happening, how people's money is being spent. Yet we're not seeing that much action, but there's definitely a lot of reaction from the public at large, especially on social media.
Yeah. So first, let me start by thanking, you mentioned it before, Matt, our all of our social media marketing guru. He somehow linked it so that the link for registration to our webinar automatically produced a picture of Jen McCormick from the leadership page of our website. I don't know how or why it did that, but it was perfection.
Mine had a picture of Brady.
Yeah, pretty much.
Clearly, that's why I didn't get the responses.
A lot of people were clicking like just to make it disappear. No, so basically what happened is I actually presented, I mentioned this before, a hypothetical very similar to the Macy's case, only instead of someone implementing a reference-based pricing program, this was a medical tourism program. In my example, the plan, the TPA, the vendor, they're very excited to get it going. They implement it, but they don't actually change the plan document. They don't notify stop loss. Somebody ends up with claims overseas, and it's not being covered by stop loss. So that's the hypothetical. The responses were all over the place. It's amazing. A number of people did advise, you know, step one, somebody should have fixed the plan document to match the process. Step two, you then provide that updated plan document to stop loss. Step three, you make sure that they've approved and everything is coordinated and good to go.
Agreed. My favorite one is the last one, Ron.
You like that?
Not to worry. Even though stop loss 100% not at fault, they'll be asked to reimburse the entire amount. And if they refuse, they'll be told that they must do it or lose all the block of business. Folks, that doesn't happen that much anymore. We're going to talk about that a little bit. I know, Ron, one of the slides that you wanted me to touch base on.
Yeah.
But I think that quote, I would say 5 years ago, that was a major issue.
I was going to say, somebody's a little bitter. I feel like my post became this opportunity for people to just express these pent-up emotions.
But the bottom line is what we're both trying to address is that when we ask the question of is there a fiduciary breach, everyone's saying that there is one, but they're blaming a different party.
That's exactly right. The finger-pointing has been incredible. You know, I am shocked by the number of people who blame the broker. That's fascinating. The number of people that say it's the broker's responsibility to rewrite the plan document and the broker's responsibility to notify the stop loss. Additionally, I can't believe how few people are pointing the finger at the vendor. The vendor comes in and starts providing these services.
Good. Hey, that's that way.
But never offered any plan language. And we've said in many webinars before, if you are meeting with a service provider or a vendor of cost containment services and they don't have plan language that matches up with the program, they don't have the instructions to implement their program and have it aligned with the plan document, then you should run in the other direction. And yet here we had an example of a vendor didn't provide plan language, and this plan did not run in the opposite direction. Yet nobody who commented, or very few who commented, are holding them responsible. Another thing that's fascinating, it's not only the number of people who said that the TPA is at fault for not updating the plan document notifying stop loss, but the fact that most of the people who are blaming the TPA are TPAs. So they're very self-critical, apparently, as a group. So that, you know, I was shocked to see pretty much everyone agreed as far as what steps needed to be taken. I think the issue is nobody agreed who was responsible to make sure that they were taken.
Right. And you know where that should be taken care of?
Where, Jen?
In the ASA.
There you go.
Get it all back to the ASA.
I like it. ASA in the USA, Jen. I appreciate it. So I think it's ultimately, at the end of the day, I think the vendor has responsibility to provide plan language. I think the TPA and broker have a responsibility to work together to make sure the plan language is implemented. And I think they have a responsibility to coordinate with stop loss. Anyone who thought that the employer is responsible because ultimately they're the fiduciary,
That makes me laugh. And the reason I say that, and you can see on the slide before you, is that just because the plan document and ERISA seem to indicate that the plan sponsor is the plan administrator, is the fiduciary, we know that the moment you take control of the plan assets and start making any kind of binding decisions on the plan, you are also a fiduciary. So once the TPA and broker start to represent to the employer that, hey, don't worry about it, you pay my fee, I've got it in hand, at that moment, you are becoming a fiduciary whether you like it or not, and it's your responsibility to make sure everything is tied up nice and tight, just like the example we just gave. So when we talk about, okay, so who's the fiduciary? A lot of people automatically say, well, you know what decides what a fiduciary is? It's my contract, right? My ASA says I'm not a fiduciary, so I'm not a fiduciary, even as you're in the midst of doing a fiduciary act. And so we've said many, many times that, A, if you take action that is a hallmark of a fiduciary, then you are a fiduciary, at least specifically as it relates to that action. And B, another thing is you can't just disclaim it in your contract. You can't just say, well, you know, even if I control the plan's assets and I unilaterally make all these decisions and I don't ask for any instruction and I completely control how the plan pays claims and I'm pretty much in total control of the plan in its entirety, per this contract, I'm not a fiduciary, so there you go. No, I'm afraid not. Additionally, many who are ultimately acting like a fiduciary, but only in a very specific limited capacity, they argue that because they didn't do other things that are hallmarks of a fiduciary, they can't be a fiduciary. So example, if I'm unilaterally deciding which claims are payable, which claims are deniable, how much I'm going to pay and when, I'm clearly acting as a fiduciary because I'm controlling the plan assets. And yet, if someone asks if I'm a fiduciary and I say, well, no, I didn't write the plan document. You know, I didn't select my stop loss carrier. I didn't pick the broker. I don't communicate the terms to my employees. Heck, those are all things a fiduciary does, so I must not be one. Wrong. You could be a fiduciary specifically to a particular task, even if you're not a fiduciary as it relates to those other tasks.
See, Ron, I think you asked the wrong question. I think the next slide, let's do it, Brady. The next slide is a question you should have asked, is just this. Who is not a fiduciary?
These days, I feel like there is nobody that is not a fiduciary.
Because if you look at the federal regulations, they'll tell you everything you need to know. And I know this is your slide, but I wanted just to read one piece of it.
Please.
A person without the power to make plan policy interpretations. Who is that? And if anybody tells me, oh, the administrator or the ASO carrier doesn't have the power, every single day we have claims managers or someone in a gray area, you have a language and a plan, hazardous activity. You can't list every single hazardous activity that someone does on a weekend, right? I mean, let's just talk about Matt, our social media guy. I mean, the stuff that he does on the weekend, you couldn't even put that in paper.
He's a walking
How do you actually write that down?
He's danger.
The point I'm trying to make is if you have someone is saying, huh, I wonder if that's a hazardous activity or not. Are they calling the plan administrator, the plan fiduciary, the plan sponsor every time going, hey, do you think Joey riding his BMX dirt bike over a cliff, thinking that he can make the 100-foot jump, is that a hazardous activity? If it's a BMX bike company, no, it's not. But if it's a nursing home, maybe it is a hazardous activity. I don't know the answer.
But what if your plan that has something in had locations in Texas and locations in Massachusetts, the same language?
Right. Yeah. And then you got two different types of people doing different things, having different activities that may or may not be hazardous. So the point is, it says right in it, without the ability, the power to make plan policy interpretations. We see that every single day. So unless a plan is black and white, where basically you're being instructed by someone, the employer, the plan sponsor, and they're telling you this is what you do. And that's easy to do on, you know, some exclusions and some definitions. But there are stuff, there are things out there that you are making a judgment call. It could be a good call, an educated decision, but it's still not your decision to make.
Yeah, Adam, I think that your use of the term judgment is the key term right there. I think anytime a decision requires that you exercise some sort of judgment, you are acting as a fiduciary. And I think for many of our partners, allies, and clients in the industry, they think that in the past they have not acted as a fiduciary because they've never been held to have breached a fiduciary duty. But I think that's less a function of their not being a fiduciary and more a function of them just being lucky or making the right calls.
So I know we're not supposed to go with their comments yet and look at people's comments, but I love the question we got. I am going to say his name. Okay, it begins with a J, last name begins with an L. But, you know, would it make sense to claim co-fiduciary status with the employer? All you're asking now, am I, again, could you? Yeah. But that's like my twins, right? They're pointing at each other. They're blaming each other if something goes wrong. Who spilled the milk? Sam did. No, Shay did. And no matter what it is, you're a co-fiduciary. You can make an argument that you're both, now you're just pointing fingers at each other on every single thing. It's what subrogation is, right? When you subrogate, someone has a car accident and the airbag deflates. Is the airbag manufacturer's mistake? Is it the car manufacturer's mistake? Who made it? Co-fiduciary. You can make that argument that a co-fiduciary, you're just adding more potential issues on more parties. And argue me both ways. So I don't think it's an answer to the problem, but I think it's an opportunity to look, something to look at.
I think you're right. I think it's a good first step because at least you're acknowledging that, yes, indeed, I am making fiduciary decisions, and frankly, I should be compensated for it. That, for me, is the biggest issue because, again, guys, I know we're all talking as if we're altruistic and we're all here to save the world, but we also need to stay financially viable if we're going to save the world. You know, Batman's utility belt, it wasn't free. And the only way you're going to be a superhero is if you're being compensated for your act. So, frankly, I think acknowledging that you are at the very least a co-fiduciary and being compensated for that is step one. Step two is then acknowledging what fiduciary duties or obligations exist and assigning them. The, you know, the traditional ASA where it says, hey, the employer is the fiduciary and responsible for all fiduciary duties, and as the TPA, I just do ministerial tasks at the end. Forget about it. You need to list out the different types of services and duties that a TPA is going to provide. You need to agree which ones are fiduciary in their nature, and you need to agree who's going to handle which. And I believe our ASA actually does delineate out the different types of services and things that are going to be handled and who's going to be responsible for what. So ultimately, when you ask the question, is the TPA the fiduciary, that really does beg the question, well, what are you doing? If you are just ministerial, and like Adam said, every time something requires some use of judgment, you're picking up the phone and calling, first of all, you're becoming really annoying. You're like that ex-girlfriend who won't go away. But second, yeah, okay, I guess you're not a fiduciary.
I doubt Ron has ever had an ex-girlfriend that wouldn't want to go away.
That, meaning a single ex-girlfriend, right?
But that's still a curious statement for you to make. It's I mean, you've never been in that situation.
I've never been the fiduciary in the relationship. But, you know, so then the next issue is, okay, so accepting that you are probably exercising some sort of judgment that you're a fiduciary, I think understanding exactly who's responsible for what, being appropriately compensated, and agreeing what tools or parameters you're going to use to make those decisions, that's the future of self-funding, and that's how we're going to coordinate our efforts.
Proactively telling the client that you want to take on the responsibility or you want nothing to do with that responsibility and pass on to a third party is the way of the future. There's gray area in between of you just hope it doesn't come up. Right, it's like that weird stepbrother you have, like you hope no one brings your name up at the conversation, at the dinner table. You want to bring this to the forefront. You want to bring this up. You want to tell people, hey, if you want me to make all the decisions, fine, but you're going to pay me to do so. If you don't want me to make the decisions, fine, but you're going to pay me not to make those decisions. Okay. Either way, it has to work. Oh, what's this guy's name? They should ban this guy from ever having daughters. Right? Every time this guy's... daughters just get kidnapped, like in Europe.
You know, it's
Was there more than one movie about that?
Yeah.
Why would they travel after the first one?
Honestly, you should stay domestic.
Like they should literally they should have the state authority take his kids away. That should be the fourth movie.
No more medical tourism.
Unbelievable.
Oh, man.
So, Jen, what would these two duties are owed?
All right, so now I know that everybody's a fiduciary, right? Is that the conclusion?
Yeah, okay. We're all excited.
We're all in this together. Some of my favorite lines from my favorite movies. So knowing that, why does it matter? Why do we need to know what it means to be a fiduciary and what obligations and requirements are now upon us? So the only reason that this is relevant is because everything is happy and everyone loves when all their claims are paid, right? The only time when a fiduciary duty is going to come into play and people are going to start questioning whether or not there was a breach is when whether a claim wasn't denied or when a claim was denied or something wasn't processed potentially appropriately. So there is a standard that is to be used when we're talking about a breach of a fiduciary duty that's owed, and that is whether or not something was handled in an arbitrary or capricious fashion. And when we're talking about whether or not a claim was handled arbitrarily or capriciously, there's certain things and certain factors that we need to look into. It's not necessarily a one-step test in order for us to decide if we did not provide the fiduciary duty or obligation that we were required to do so under ERISA. The first is making sure that we're acting in the interest of the plan participants and their beneficiaries for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits to them. So as an example of this, what we've been talking about without actually talking about it is that we need to know what discretion means. We need to have a fair interpretation of what we're deciding is hazardous or not hazardous. Are we making sure that we're providing the same analysis and the same facts and consistently providing them on a case-by-case basis? The next is making sure that we're following the plan document, unless inconsistent with ERISA. So we need to make sure that we're constructing the language uniformly and consistently across the board, across all the programs that might be relevant, that we are interpreting how those provisions might apply to a provider, to a participant, to a spouse in the same manner, that we're prudently managing the assets of the plan, that we're not making sure that we're putting a program into the plan document that doesn't necessarily have the language to adopt or actually would be appropriate for what that program would require, and making sure that we're only paying reasonable plan expenses. So we have an obligation in order to pay things that are only appropriate, that are reasonable, eligible medical plan expenses. All right. So going into the first bullet that is important here is when we're acting solely in the plan interest or the interest of the plan participants, we need to remember that the employer is the business, but the plan is not. The plan is a separate, distinct entity from the employer. It has their own tax ID number, their own obligations, own prudential trust requirements. And under ERISA, similar to the pension rules, there is an obligation to make sure that when we're paying claims that there's no instances of embezzlement, falsifying documents, that we are treating the plan and the assets that belong to the plan participants in a consistent fashion. So there are a lot of requests that we have seen lately where we want to make sure that we're looking in the best interest of the plan participants, and maybe one of the best interests of the plan participants is to have an exception report. Maybe we know that there was the opportunity here. We have a really sick employee, and this employee has been so great to us, but we have a specific provision in our plan that would require us to cap the payment or potentially not cover that claim. So while that would be in the best interest of the plan participant to potentially have an exception report and pay that claim, that's not acting in the best interest of the plan. So you have to remember there is a balance between the plan and the plan participant.
Great point. Best interest of the plan, right? Question comes up. If an employer moves from a reference-based pricing program to a fully insured program, could that be a breach of fiduciary responsibility? That alone cannot be. It comes down to a very simple thing. Would I want that as someone who supports self-funding and not the fully insured market, push up an advocate of self-funding? I want it to say, oh, yeah, if anyone is fully insured, you definitely are breaching your fiduciary duty. Has nothing to do with it. It's what's in the plan's best interest. If I have a reference-based pricing program whose plan document says, guess what? We're going to reimburse every facility Medicare plus 5,000%.
Mm-hmm.
Is that reference-based pricing?
Certainly is.
Right. You might have a fully insured plan that says, you know what? We're just really generous. We're going to give you the Cadillac coverage. Forget that Cadillac. Ferrari coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And we're only going to charge you $500 a month for your family. What's better for the plan? Which option?
I'm going to go with B.
Right. It has nothing to do with the type of plan design. It's what the actual design is. What are you spending? Is there a bunch of balance billing where you don't have sign-off and the plan ends up paying 100% of bill charges anyways?
Right.
It's not as simple as what program is better, self-funding with a TPA or self-funding with an ASO. It comes down to what is the plan spend and what parameters and pricing structures you have in place to make sure you're not just wasting plan assets. That's the right question to ask.
Right,
sorry,
exactly Jeff. The point. So there's two things that we need to keep in mind. The fiduciary duties that are old, there's two parts. The first is compliance. Obviously, we have to comply with the risk. So we have to know that what obligations and responsibilities we're responsible for under the specific regulations are being adhered to. Second, and more important, I'd argue, is making sure that the obligations are being done and compliantly handled in a cost containment fashion. There's more than just saying, I'm coloring within the lines. You have to make sure that you are doing so in the best interest of the plan. And one of the problems that we have seen, particularly lately, is you have a situation where there's a high claim, there's a high situation, there's an employee whose claims are going to potentially bankrupt the plan, and you know that you have to administer the plan in accordance with the plan terms, but that is not in the best interest of the plan. It's unanticipated. It's a cost that is too high. How do you handle those situations? You have to balance the cost containment aspect with the compliance aspect, because both are responsibilities that you are owed as a fiduciary.
Well said, Jen. Ron?
Yeah, so I like what you guys are saying, which is basically that as a fiduciary, it's your responsibility to perform a cost-benefit analysis. And, you know, going back to that example, Adam, fully insured versus self-funded with reference-based pricing, I would agree that if all things are equal and the reference-based pricing plan is paying $500, whereas the fully insured is going to cost $1,000, clearly you're better off with the self-funded plan. But if then you're spending another $1,000 on defense and constant conflicts and balance billing issues, obviously, first of all, your program is not being run properly. But let's say that, again, is the hypothetical. Well, now you're spending a total of $1,500, $500 on the claim, $1,000 on defense. Suddenly now that fully insured product at $1,000 net is better off. So again, every decision you make, it's a cost-benefit analysis. And speaking of not only money that you're spending, but money that you're saving, you know, they say a penny saved is a penny earned. And I would say then the opposite is also true, that a penny earned is a penny saved. And if you are not taking advantage of opportunities to actually recover money for the plan, that's just as bad as you wrongfully spending it in the first place, wasting it. Again, if you spend $10 on something that should only cost $5, you've wasted $5. If you spend $10 and discover later that it should only be $5, not recouping that $5 is the same wasted $5. And that's where I think things like subrogation and overpayment recovery really are important as a fiduciary. Not only are you proactively looking at how you're spending money, but you're also looking at opportunities to recover money that's already been spent. Additionally, when you look at the different types of expenses that you're spending as a plan, don't only focus on medical expenses. I know it's easy to look at that because that is the primary cost driver for just about any health benefit plan, is how much am I spending on this specialty drug or that dialysis or this flu shot. But you should also be looking at other extra expenditures that the plan is facing, things like fees and costs. Ensure that you can justify things. If you're spending $10,000 on a program that routinely is only saving $5,000 for the plan, maybe it's time to shed that program and just spend the $5 that you're saving. So again, it's important to constantly audit and look at what you're spending money on, not just health benefits, but the entirety of the plan.
Well said, Ron. So just to give you an example, one of the things that we've been noticing, especially talking about being prudent with plan assets, we now at FIA, in full disclosure, we have two attorneys who do nothing but deal with stop-loss claim exclusions. That's it. Whether, you know, I'm not saying which carriers are good or which ones are bad, which MGUs are good or bad. It's just the fact that we're seeing more and more exclusion-type issues, claims not being reimbursed. So I thought, I wonder why this is happening so often. Because I remember there was a comment earlier where, yeah, we can just pick up the phone and call the carrier and say, hey, we have a lot of work with you. Let's work through this gray area. Now it seems the gray area is just being denied. So what I did was I just reached out to a bunch of our clients and I asked them. And here's what I found out. Five to 10 years ago, 80% of all stop loss business was placed by the TPA. Only 20% by the brokers. Today, it's 50-50. And it's trending towards more brokers placing stop loss than the TPA. So the TPA is administering a claim. They're processing the claim. They're writing the plan document, working with FIA, whatever. But they don't have that relationship with that particular stop loss carrier, MGU, on a particular group. Therefore, they're at arm's length. They can't just pick up the phone and go, hey, we have a great relationship with your organization. We have all this business with you. We're seeing a lot more of that. And what I then noticed was, 9 out of 10 of the claims that we have that we're being hired to look at, guess who placed the stop loss business? Not the TPA. So we're noticing a trend of more denials, more less cooperation, and more of that happening because more and more of this business is being placed by an outside third party. So whether or not it's a good thing, at the end of the day, that's the reality of what's happening, and we're seeing that trend continue. So we would expect these exclusions and denial issues to continue to happen as well. Ron, let's turn it back over to you when we talk about only paying what's reasonable. And again, making sure your vendors and carriers are vetted in order to identify what that actually means. Ron?
So one of the expenses that I think are extremely reasonable and every fiduciary is frankly obligated to spend is to make sure that the relationships you're talking about, Adam, are worked out ahead of time. Because I fear that maybe the knee-jerk reaction to what you're expressing is this concern that, well, hey, if any time a broker or a plan brings a stop-loss carrier to me instead of being placed by me, I'm going to end up in trouble. I shouldn't allow it anymore. That's not the right answer because you're going to lose business that way. Instead, take the time, spend the money, and ensure that everything is aligned ahead of time. That means reviewing the stop-loss policy alongside the plan document alongside the ASA. That means explaining to the broker and the plan your concern that if there's a conflict, this is not a carrier that you vetted, and therefore you need them to accept liability or responsibility for those conflicts. These are the types of proactive actions that a good fiduciary is going to take so that you don't have to turn the business away, but if there ever is a conflict, everybody knows who's responsible for what. In addition to that, other types of programs, cost containment, we've mentioned it already, things like carve-outs, reference-based pricing, whatever. Again, question the status quo, but do so in a way that's not going to cost the plan more than makes sense.
So how is Brady back on this again?
Honestly, he's
amazing, isn't it?
He's the starter and the closer.
Unbelievable. What can we do to protect ourselves quickly?
Yeah, I mean, all this talk of liability is pretty scary and not much time is left, but a few important things that you can do as a plan to protect yourself, and one of them is to engage a neutral third party when you can. So obviously courts are going to like it when you're being objective in your review, when you're using, like, for example, third-party medical review or, groups to review complicated claims. They provide you objective analysis. They tell you what their opinion is. And it's crucial. Having claims or appeals reviewed is the best way to prove good faith. You don't want to be accused of bad faith. And finally, outsourcing final-level appeals. Make sure that you're using an IRO with a good reputation when you can, and make sure the plan has done what it's promised to do.
Brady, why don't you just tell them to hire FIA?
I mean, that's kind of what this is about. But in reality, also, don't deviate from the terms of your SPD. We talked about this before, with Jen mentioned it. It's the easiest way to violate fiduciary duties. Don't do it. Just make sure you're applying the terms of your plan consistently. This is what the courts and the IROs are going to look for. Have your SPD reviewed. Things change all the time, definitions, exclusions. And we can provide you with limited scope reviews that are just from one small level all the way up to a full compliance review and cost containment review, depending on what your need is.
So just real quick, Brady, I want to give you a little kudos here and a shout-out. Over the weekend, Brady worked on a memo for me. We had a client ask, help, what can we do? We have a particular plan member who hasn't been at work, and he has all these claims. What can we do? Brady read the plan doc, and if they just read the plan doc on its own, they would have saw, heck, we had it. What did you call the word? The moment? Where it's, I think it would what word you use. But basically, they hit a point in time where they could just literally file a piece of paper, send a notice to the particular member and said, you're not covered under the plan anymore.
Right.
Yep. That's it. And now what's going to happen is they have paid claims, and now we're going to have a stop-loss carrier who's going to look at the plan doc and say, not covered. There's the example. So, again, what can you do to protect yourself? Again, talk to us, work with us, but more importantly even than that, first, make sure your plan is compliant. Second, make sure you follow the terms of your plan. And third, if it's a situation where you can see yourself potentially getting into trouble, just realize that you probably will get into trouble in those particular situations. Our next webinar is going to be in 2018, January 18th, free webinar. This is a photo of all of us over the summer at one of our volunteer events at the Boys and Girls Club in Brockton. I'm the handsome gentleman right first row, all the way to the right on kneeling down. Anyways, feel free to join us on that particular date. We don't have any time to review your questions, but I'm assuming, Matt, we will go over all the questions and respond to them. I do have time for one, but just really quick. Under an RPP pricing plan, if a provider accepts claim payment, can they then go back to the employer to balance bill? Sure. Of course they can. Now, there's going to be some instances on, oh, do they deposit the check? Did the plan language say if it deposits this check? There's a lot that goes into it. It's not a yes or no answer. There's a lot of gray area. Depends on the plan language says, what the EOB says, what the back of the check might say, et cetera. But we'll obviously get into this and more. Please make sure you tune into our podcast. We'll have it posted tomorrow afternoon sometime. Hopefully we have some great news breaking later on today. On behalf of Brady, Jen, Ron, and myself, thank you so much for joining us. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy New Year. Thank you. Thank you.